does paradise mean to you? Is it a happy, healthy family? Is it a pristine, private Hawaiian beach? Or is it an exceptional cup of coffee that you don't even need to leave your house for? Well, I think you know my answer already because I've been living in paradise for years. Because I made the switch to Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that are always fair trade. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half calf. But the best part is Sparkplug delivers this outstanding coffee to you in Canada or the US within 1 week of custom roasting it here in Toronto, so that when it reaches you, it's always guaranteed fresh, and you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug as you need it, or you can join the Autopilot Coffee Club and enjoy regular deliveries. It's totally customizable and flexible, all the convenience with none of the commitment, and if you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT, that's all one word with the number 100, Sparkplug will give you 20% off your next coffee order. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Yeah, but paradise can go fuck itself.
TOP 100
and action.
Hey kids and kitty cats, and thanks for sparking up the 399th Ellis's Analysis. We do a flip-flop run back to the past to review movie classics, and we spoil. In our nearly 400 episodes, we've tackled some impressive titles, so do some scrolling to see just how impressive that collection is. I'm the father of none who nevertheless does like curling up on the couch with a couple of special ladies, Ryan Ellis.
Is it me and our dog,
We're
Tilly?
We're getting to that. And here's one of those ladies who could probably cry underwater if she gave it a shot, my wife, Bev.
That's me.
Tilly is the other lady. Our dog, for those who might be new to this podcast.
Only one of us likes ice cream.
The dogs like the ice cream cones. The two boy dogs do, at least.
Yeah. Tilly could care less.
Tilly is not a food dog. Okay, then. The coming attraction's opinion question for The Descendants. Which performance in an Alexander Payne movie do you think is the best of them all? Reese Witherspoon in Election, or I guess you could say Matthew Broderick in that same movie. Jack Nicholson in About Schmidt. Paul Giamatti in Sideways, Bruce Dern, or again, Will Forte is really the lead of Nebraska, or George Clooney in The Descendants, or maybe some other movie that Payne has made.
This is an impossible choice.
It really is a tough one.
Because if there's one thing Payne has a gift for, it is directing incredible performances out of his actors. But I'm just going to go for Reese Witherspoon, baby, Tracy Flick. Iconic!
Tracy Fuck, when it's all in caps. I never loved Sideways nor Paul Giamatti in it, but most of Payne's leading performances are excellent. Nicholson's work in About Schmidt was such a pleasant surprise, especially from him at that point. But the 1-2 punch of Broderick and Witherspoon in Election is nearly impossible to beat. Not to say that Clooney's not terrific, and others would say Giamatti is. People in Citizen Ruth.
You gotta give Nicholson credit for playing so against type. I can't think of another movie he's done where he's stretching himself as much as he is in About Schmidt. And he is incredible in that film.
In his older years, that's true. His younger years, he did performances like that all the time.
Okay, fair. But he was just a different kind of man back then. He's just a person who exudes being a winner, which George Clooney does too, whereas most of Alexander Payne's lead characters are losers that are always fighting against being a loser.
If not losers, not winners. Mm-hmm. They're somewhere in between. That definitely applies to Matt King. That applies to Warren Schmidt. One of the great moments in any of the Payne movies, or any Nicholson movie for that matter, isn't About Schmidt, when Warren has just retired and he was supposed to be this bigwig at this Nebraska insurance company. He goes back to offer some help and expertise. And they're polite with him, but they don't need his help. And that's understandable, I guess. He did retire. This other guy needs a chance to do the job. It's only been a matter of weeks, maybe even days. But then he goes downstairs to the main level and sees all his boxes sitting in storage, as if none of that ever mattered. That moment is more important than almost anything else he does in the whole film, the look on his face. And Payne has really nailed those small moments. And Clooney, it's funny because he has got that Nicholson vibe in some ways. I think Clooney could have been the Oscar guy that Nicholson used to be. I've said Street has been over Nicholson a lot of the time in recent years, but Clooney could be the guy they go to at the Oscars, that Mr. Cool over there.
Oh, yeah. He's one of the greatest movie stars of his generation by a country mile.
And Clooney playing a sort of loser in this, even though he's doing pretty well in life. And that's also true about Nicholson's character, and somewhat true about Broderick's character before things go downhill in Election. And it's somewhat true about Giamatti's character in Sideways before that movie really changes what's going on in it. Okay, yeah, we agree. Election. Some good movies, though. About Schmidt is a movie I've seen many times. I've liked it lots of times. And hey, we shouldn't discount Nebraska either, because Will Forte is not exactly a dramatic actor, but that movie's mostly a drama. And then Bruce Dern, doing very little, but some of the best work he's ever done at his 80 years old or something by that point. Okay, back to this movie then, The Descendants. Or, your boyfriend's bad and you're gonna die a vegetable. Hey nah, your boyfriend's bad. It played at a bunch of festivals 10 years ago, then was released by Fax Searchlight to qualify for the Oscars in December 2011. And of course it's on Disney Plus now because it's a Fox property, or was. The movie made 4 times the budget domestically, then more than doubled that amount worldwide. So obviously, by any metric, The Descendants is a success, or was a success, 10 years ago. Because it's been 10 years, Bev, you probably should remind people what the movie's about, so please give them the skinny on The Descendants.
George Clooney is Matt King, the patriarch of a large extended family of descendants of Hawaiian royalty. A family that's being forced to sell their shared inheritance, a large, pristine piece of land on Kauai. While Matt grapples with that decision, he must also grapple with a much more personal crisis when his wife is rendered comatose by a tragic boating accident.
Hey, nah.
This puts a strain on the already fragile relationships between Matt and his friends, his in-laws, but especially his 2 troubled daughters as they come to terms with the fact that their flawed and complicated mother will never wake up. So, you know, a comedy!
Dramedy, at least, yeah. Or, in a nutshell, cheating bitch got what she deserved.
Oh my god. Well, we will certainly debate that. The movie has a lot to say about infidelity.
I'm not against the infidelity. I thought it was funny. The hey-nah thing in this. I don't really hate Elizabeth. We don't really know her story. We don't ever get her side of it. And the marriage obviously wasn't very good to begin with. So that's one reason why she was cheating. And people cheat for all kinds of reasons. We'll never understand unless we're in their shoes. And some of those reasons are probably awfully legitimate if you hear it from their point of view. But we never get that from her because, apart from the very brief beginning where we see her on a jet ski? Well, anyway, in the ocean.
Boat. I imagine that's the moment shortly before she dies. Her on a boat, it's going fast. She has this look of real joy on her face. It's such an interesting little snapshot to give us into Elizabeth. They never show flashbacks. They just show us this one little moment of her life. And in that moment, she's experiencing true, pure joy. And then everything after that is the aftermath of her accident.
And the friends tell Matt later on that she was going to ask for a divorce.
Like you say, well, we can't trust his version of events. But even his version of events is that he was not a very good husband.
He admits it.
And their divorce wasn't really all that surprising that she would want out of the marriage. Yeah, I get it.
He's the understudy parent, as he says in the voiceover. Very similar to the Up in the Air voiceover. I watched that not that long ago, maybe a couple months ago. Again, I've seen Up in the Air probably 4 times, but it's been a while. And the voiceover in these 2 movies, only 2 years apart, are very similar. Clooney plays not a loser in that movie, but at the end, he seems to be, well, it depends how you view it, I guess, truly adrift, truly alone. What did he really accomplish in his life? And in this movie, it's got a whole different ending.
Can Clooney ever really play a loser?
That's part of the problem, is that you get a movie star like a Clooney, we talked about Nicholson already, some of these people that he's cast, Payne has in his big films, and they really never truly can sink into a role when they're those kinds of stars. You can't really truly look past them. Maybe a Christian Bale is one of those guys who's obviously a movie star because of the way he acts. And maybe back in the 70s, De Niro and Hoffman, those kinds of guys, even Pacino to some degree, and Nicholson in his early days could get past the movie star thing. But I'm not so sure that was necessarily always true with them. It isn't anymore with any of those people. And Clooney's one of those people that, yeah, he's in a different way. John Wayne, Charlton Heston, he's George Clooney.
And even before he was George Clooney, I would just argue that his charisma overcomes any ability for us as the audience to see him as a true loser. Matthew Broderick actually does sell it.
True.
Will Forte, Paul Giamatti, you buy it that their whole persona, their ego, is fragile and that it actually could fall apart at any moment, whereas Clooney just has such a bedrock of charisma that there's no world where I truly believe he's a loser. I can think of one movie where he does come across as a true loser, and that's Burn After Reading. Not even Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, because he's kind of a loser. Well, he's a winner in that movie in the end. But Burn After Reading, he's a legit loser. I buy it in that movie, but maybe only the Coens can pull it off. And And I would argue that Alexander Payne in this film, he does pull his punches. Compared to his earlier work, including Nebraska, I would say that this film is the movie where Alexander Payne pulls his punches and is the kindest to his protagonist. And we're talking about a director who just is so cruel to his protagonists. He puts his characters through hell and he forces the audience to watch truly uncomfortable moments. And just when you think you can't take any more, they get a bee sting in the eye. Oh my God, please have mercy on this poor person. But I never felt that in The Descendants, and it doesn't help that he also cast just one of the most charming men in Hollywood. I love his performance in this movie. I think for Clooney especially, it's one of his best performances. But for an Alexander Payne film, it's curiously kind.
Yeah, you can't stick that round peg in the square hole or vice versa entirely, no matter how much Clooney wants that to happen. And he does do his best. He wanted to play the Thomas Hayden Church role in Sideways. I think pretty badly, in fact.
Oh, wow.
But they wanted a lesser-known actor than Clooney was, because Church had done plenty of things, including Wings, and he got nominated for an Oscar for that performance, and he's very fun and very funny in that movie. And I wouldn't say Clooney was bad casting for that, but I could see why he would want that role. So finally, 8 years later, 7 years later, he gets this role instead and does the best he can. But yeah, there's an element, and it's nothing against him or Payne or anybody else, but maybe in some small way, despite the good performance, it's miscasting.
Yeah. I do think there was one other part that was miscast in this film, and you might disagree with me. The more times I've seen this film, the more I think about it, I feel like Judy Greer was a huge mistake.
Really? Because she's good?
Listen, I love Judy Greer, but that's part of the problem. Judy Greer is just one of the most affable, lovable actresses in Hollywood. And I think that the part of Julie...
Should have been a bitch.
Not a bitch, but just somebody harder to like. Two bad things happened to her, and to sympathize with her too much is kind of a mistake. She gets cheated on, and she's just so vulnerable in that moment, and your heart goes out to her 100%. You were totally on her side. And then there's that moment where Clooney kisses her. If the film was made today, that scene would be completely different, because it's just weird that he kisses her out of nowhere. That she
It's a revenge kiss, and it doesn't go anywhere.
It doesn't go anywhere, but she just kind of reacts like, what? A strange man just kissed me on my porch? It's just like a kind of moment that doesn't fit in a movie in 2021 the way it did in 2011. But her final scene, which is the most important scene she has, where she's in the hospital room and she starts off by saying, I forgive you, Elizabeth, and then gets angry, and Clooney has to unceremoniously usher her.
Enough.
All right, that's enough. In both of those cases, because Judy Greer is so nice, Matt is being mean to this innocent, fragile little creature that doesn't deserve any of this. And I was racking my brain for what actress would have pulled it off where you like her and they're good, but you can believe that they're crazy is too crazy for somebody to tolerate. And I thought Parker Posey. Imagine Parker Posey in that role. Imagine Parker Posey in that hospital room saying, I forgive you!
Like, maybe too much.
Out.
Maybe too much,
but I don't know, for an Alexander Payne film, and for that scene, which is supposed to get a little bit crazy, it's definitely supposed to play for comedy, but it's just not funny when Judy Greer is the butt of the joke because we all love her too much. But if it was Parker Posey and he has to just shuffle her out of the room and make her not his problem, then it would just be like straight comedy. The very next scene, of course, is another very important scene in the film where he finally just concedes to say goodbye to his wife who's hurt him, come to terms with his grief and pain that he's going through. For us to turn around and sympathize with him after he's done something pretty mean to somebody else who's hurting, who we sympathize with, it's just like a bit of an error on the part of Payne to cast Clooney. I think we both agree that he's not ideal casting for this part, although I love him. I think he's great and everything. But it makes the film maybe just a little bit too Hollywood when it could have had the same excellent edge that all of his other films have. But I really strongly believe that Judy Greer is miscast in this film. I love Matthew Lillard. Such interesting casting for that part, especially because he's so much weirder looking than Clooney. When you're like married to Clooney and you cheat on him with Matthew Lillard.
Who I think is a lot younger as well, which is maybe part of the point. But the guy from Scream and the guy from Scooby-Doo, Shaggy, of course, and some other films that Lillard has made that aren't serious. Not that he has to be a serious actor or a serious character in the film, but he is playing a serious character in the film. And that's maybe done partly for comedy. Let's go with somebody who's not the obvious person. Maybe it's a little bit of a play on, I think it's Manhattan. I know Woody Allen's terrible anyway. I'll hate his guts. But that great idea that Diane Keaton's idealized some dude. I think his name is Donnie, her therapist. And we've heard about him for a while. We finally see him, and it's Wally Shawn. We all love Wally Shawn, but he is not what you were picturing at all when Diane Keaton has been describing this guy for 20 or 30 minutes all this time leading up to that point.
And that's romantic competition for Woody Allen. So imagine what romantic competition for George Clooney should look like. Matthew Lillard, he's not a slouch. Listen, he's fine.
He's not it.
Yeah. He's not holding a candle to George Clooney.
Mm-hmm. And we haven't even talked about one of the better performances in the whole film. We'll get to that in a second. But first, let's go through a little bit of number action here. So the Rotten Tomatoes critics like this film fairly strongly. 87% of them on Rotten Tomatoes say good, good. 8.1 out of 10 was the average. And the sample size is 268 reviews. And of course, a modern movie is going to have a lot of reviews. So obviously, that's a fair sample, not some movie from 1950 that has 5 reviews and it's 92% or something. And 79% of audiences liked it as well. It was 39th at the 2011 U.S. box office. We've covered a lot of movies already from 2011 this year. Bridesmaids was number 14. We did that earlier in the year. Contagion we did last year when the pandemic was just barely getting started. It was 45th in 2011. And Young Adult was 125th. We covered that a few months ago. It won one Oscar for the adapted screenplay. It was based on Kawhi Hart Hemmings' 2007 novel. And she plays Matt's secretary in this movie as well. And she was at the Oscars, I believe. I watched the speech by Alexander Payne, Nat Faxon and Jim Rash, and Payne does mention her and looks out from the audience, so she must have been there as well, which is nice. Payne won his second Oscar because he won his first for Sideways. I wouldn't say either of these are his best screenplays, but he's got 2 Oscars as a writer. If he wins a third, then he's in a very elite group of people. It was also nominated for Best Picture, Best Director for Payne, Best Actor for Clooney, and The Editing. So 5 nominations in total. And what was not a very good year for Oscar nominations. I'm not saying 2011 was a terrible year, but for the Oscar nominations, this is the year The Artist won. Ugh. And as much as we didn't love that movie, there wasn't a tremendous amount of competition. But then again, this was certainly better. And so was, I think, the best movie of all the nominees. And I guess my favorite that year, or did I say Melancholia? Maybe I said Melancholia, and I know you did too. But Moneyball.
Wasn't this the year of A Separation?
True.
What the was actual
I'm thinking about the movies that were nominated 2011? For Best Picture.
Yeah, okay. I would say A Separation is the best film of 2011, but I'm with you, Melancholia. I have a bizarre obsession with that film, so it might be my favorite of 2011.
But a lot of the ones we just mentioned weren't even nominated for Best Picture. This was, though, and we're picking it because why not? We'll go to Hawaii, we get a Clooney film, we've only done a few of those ever. We've only done, I think, 1 Payne film before this, and that was Election. We'll get into the Rose McGowan thing at some point. We won't ignore that for those who might be wondering. But okay, we've been talking for a while here. What do you think of The Descendants?
Alexander Payne is famous for giving audiences these really complex, flawed characters, forcing us to grapple with some complex conflicts. And like I said, The Descendants, least challenging of his films. But the writing is still really sharp and complex. It's full of these really rich and moving performances. It made Shailene Woodley a movie star. And it's just a really funny, interesting, affable film. This is my 3rd viewing, and it's just a world I love entering.
I've seen it, I guess, 3 times as well, and I felt about the same each time. Never loved it, certainly didn't dislike it, but never really truly glommed onto it and said, yeah, wonderful movie, should have won a bunch of awards, including the screenplay award.
I feel like all the threads don't necessarily come together at the end. They're trying really hard to make this connection between his personal crisis and the sale of the land, and I have...
Which is also so personal.
It is personal, but I have mixed feelings about that whole subplot, and I don't feel like it gels at the end.
It doesn't really in this
point. Okay, I'm glad you agree with me. I really, really love this movie a lot, but I have to admit that it doesn't totally work. They were trying to get some theme to come through for the 2 stories to have parallels, but I'm just never feeling it. I always feel like I'm missing something. You might be able to intellectually explain it to me. I did research about this film, and there was nobody that could really draw that perfect line between the crisis with his family and how he needed to bond with his daughters and become a father.
And let his wife go.
And let his wife go and do the right thing in every respect with that. And the decision that he had to make about this pristine land in Hawaii. They're both important stories that I care about, but I could never mend the two.
I'm with you on that. The thing I liked the most this time that I'd ever really felt before, not that I didn't feel this before, but really strongly this time, and I don't know why she wasn't nominated for Best Supporting Actress, but not only Shailene Woodley's performance as a young girl, not even 20 years old, but her chemistry with Clooney. And that, of course, goes to both of them. It goes to Payne. It goes to editing. So many factors. And I read that Clooney actually stayed close to her. Maybe in Hollywood speak, he talks to her once every 3 years, but he thinks of her as another daughter. I guess they have a daughter, he and... I'm all...
They have twins, but they were born well after of he course, made yeah. this movie, so...
But I loved how Matt talks to Alex like an adult. When he recruits her, when she's drunk as well, I thought maybe she was a drinker. I forgot if that was going to be a subplot in the whole film. She'd be sneaking booze. It seems like she's just drunk that night because she's a kid. Yeah. And she's partying and she's on another island, the big island, as it turns out. When Matt and Scotty go to find her, she's drunk that one night. It's not like it's a recurring problem. She's a high school student.
Yeah, my parents caught me drunk when I was that age, too.
Got you drunk or caught you drunk?
Well, actually, my mother did get me drunk.
I heard got, but I think you said caught. Caught.
I definitely got caught drunk. My mother also, well, listen, it wasn't actually getting in trouble when you got caught drinking at my mother's house, so maybe it's a bad example. But we never see her use alcohol or drugs again for the rest of the film. She has an argument with him where she says, I have cleaned up my act. You happened to show up the night that I was partying, but my grades are better and I've got my act together, so you're just not noticing. So don't act like just because you had this bad timing. And she kind of lives that for the rest of the film. She's cheeky with him. She's mouthy, but so is Scotty.
She does not act like a kid.
No,
I love that
doesn't.
In this movie. And he talks to her, like I said, like an adult when he says to her about, you got to help me take care of Scotty. The way Clooney talks to her, it might as well be the way he would say that to Elizabeth. And I mean that completely as a compliment to the performances, the writing.
And they say over and over, she's just like her mother. She's just like Elizabeth. And apparently Scotty is too. In a way, we know Elizabeth, even though we don't get to know her, because her daughters are both just like her. When he is saying to his wife in a coma, you were my love, but you were my pain. You were pain in my ass, too.
These kids will be now.
These kids
will be. They
were
and they will be.
That's who he was married to. He's not freed of the burden of this woman who was so difficult because he has to raise her daughters now. But there's so much love there, and that's why it never feels too heavy.
So people raved at the time about Woodley crying underwater when he tells her that the mother's going to die. And of course, that's a different way to handle things in movies or reality, too. It's not that your mother did die. It's that your mother is going to die. And it's not that she's going to die at any old time. It's when we decide to let it happen, because she could be on these machines for a very long time to come.
Oh, no, the doctors are clear, because she had a living will. Because he says, I mean, if we decide to do this, and the doctor's like, I'm sorry, it's when. We have a legal obligation to do this.
I mean, in a medical sense, she doesn't have to go any certain time. Okay, you're right. Legally, she does. Medically, she doesn't.
They make a big deal out of the living will. That's
no,
a big
what I'm saying is that, okay, so somebody gets a car accident and they're clinging to life. Somehow the paramedics saved this person for a couple of hours and you better say goodbye. Like in Signs, right? Mel Gibson shows up. His wife has one little thing to say to him, or a few things, I guess, because they're all prophetic.
Or in recently covered Independence Day.
Right.
Where Mary McDonald in full hair.
Lucid to the end.
Lucid to the end. Sparkling eyes. I'm dying.
But that's the point, though, is that the mother's not dead, but she's going to be. So Woodley cries underwater. People raved about that, as they should. Clooney did, too, when you read online about that.
It's a powerful moment.
But their chemistry in general is the thing. I don't know that it got enough credit, because people talk about the crying underwater thing. But they should have talked more about how those two play off each other. It feels like a father and a daughter. It feels like it's a real relationship. There's no hint in any weird way about how maybe he's into her because it is his wife incarnate. There's nothing like that. And it's almost a shame that they never work together again. She's done some good work in other things. I don't really know much about the Divergent series, but she's the star of those movies. The Fault in Our Stars was fine. I saw it once. Very good and a great cast. Reese Witherspoon, of course, is the main star. Nicole Kidman in Big Little Lies. But Shailene Woodley pulls her weight in that as well. But in one of her first performances, it may be the best thing she's ever done.
I
don't think I felt like that the first few times I saw the movie. But this time, thinking, where is that Oscar nomination for Best Supporting Actress and maybe even a win?
And she's so young. She was still a teenager, right?
Yeah.
And she was not a nobody, because she was the star of a television series called The Secret Life of the American Teenager, which I never watched, but I couldn't avoid because I worked on youth programming at the time.
She wasn't even 20 when it came out. She was born in November 91. Okay, she was 20 when it came out, but she wasn't 20 when they made it.
Still, even if she was 21, it's an incredible performance for someone so young. And she looks young. You get so much more when you cast somebody their real age. It's just so hard to find actors that are that good. But she is so good. People talked about her getting a nomination, I remember, for her performance in this movie. And I would say that while people knew her from Secret Life of an American Teenager, this movie made her a star. Everybody sat up and paid attention to her from this moment on. It's probably why she got Divergent and why she's a household name now.
Big ups for Woodley. So it is a road movie of sorts, because they're on the road a lot in their quest to find Brian, really. Scotty doesn't know much about that, nor does Sid, the comic relief in this movie. And he's quite funny. I guess in the book he wasn't comic relief, but they made Nick Kraus, who I think steals the whole film, really. Even though Woodley's probably the best thing right up there with Clooney, their relationship in general. So Woodley and Clooney's relationship, number one. His performance, maybe number two. Hers, number three. Interchangeable there. But right after all those people, and maybe close to being as good as Nick Kraus in the funny role as Sid, and a bit of a truth teller as well. I kept on waiting. I haven't seen this movie in so long, I forgot if it was going to happen. When he talks truth to Matt late at night and says good things to him and helps him out, that Matt would say thanks. But he doesn't. I like that touch. He should have. It would have been a good gesture. It would have been the right thing to do for this kid who's actually, in that moment at least, quite bright.
And very insightful and generous. He's dopey and he literally takes punches. Great comedy
Robert
moment.
Forster, Robert Forster, that was funny,
yeah. What a great moment when he punches him and just his shock, like, he actually punched me. He takes insults from everybody. He takes literal punches and he just sticks around because he's there for his friend. I read in some reviews they called him her boyfriend, but I don't think that they're boyfriend, girlfriend. I think they outright deny it. They're just friends that he's there for her to lean on because, as we learn much later in the film, his father died. And so they have this in common, which is really rare for kids that age to have somebody else who could share that experience with them. So then you understand their bond. You understand why she brings him everywhere with her and she's strong-headed enough to get her way, which is great.
So apart from the movie needing someone like him to be on the journey for the comedy and everything for Matt to talk to other than just his daughters, why else would he be there? If he's a boyfriend, you got to wonder if Matt would allow that. But when it's just a friend, okay. Then that actually says a lot about how much he trusts Alex's judgment, that she tells him that and he believes her, because a lot of fathers would say, he's not coming along with us, especially in hotel rooms, and we're going to be away several nights. It is a weird quest, too, because most of their travels, when they do go on the road, is effectively to find Brian. And it's because he does want to say, fuck you, she's dying, or how's it go? She's dying, fuck you, or however that is anyway. But he wants to give Brian the chance to come and say goodbye in person. But he's so much of a coward that he doesn't do that. Instead, as you said earlier, Judy Greer's character, the wife of Brian, does. How about that scene between Matt and Brian? There's no violence, no hitting. A lot of big movies, maybe not Clooney movies so much. He's not really a violent character in most of his movies. But would have had some kind of punch. Now, if he does, Julie's on to him. And then you've got to explain, why did you hit my husband? But instead, it's a bit of an argument in their house that she doesn't know ended up being an argument until we see off screen, we find out off screen, that he did tell her that he cheated on her.
You talk about good performances. I don't know if I've ever seen Matthew Lillard be better in a movie. I've always liked him. I find him very charming and funny and goofy. Loved him in the Scream movies. And just in general, he's one of those actors that I'm always rooting for.
A Scream movie. I don't believe he was in the sequels.
Oh, yeah,
other than maybe
not.
Archive footage.
Yeah, you're right. Sorry, my bad.
My glasses did get pushed back there.
He's only in the first Scream movie, but in his scene, and he really just has that one really important scene where he's in the beach house and coming to terms with the fact that his lover's husband is standing at the door telling him that she's dead, but the fear in his eyes. Mm. I love his performance in that moment. Did you love her? And he can't lie. He doesn't lie to him. I don't know what the right answer would be in that scenario anyway, if you were going to tell somebody what they wanted to
Matt
hear.
Matt says, you could have lied.
You could have lied, yeah. Oh, wait, and he does lie. That's right. It's like, were you ever in my bedroom? Just once. You could have lied. Okay, it was twice.
That's what it was, right,
what
yeah.
What a great lie. It's not even just that he's been caught by his lover's husband. And it's not even just that his whole family could be torn apart by this person in his kitchen who's just like a loaded gun ready to destroy his family. It's also that this is the man that decides whether he becomes rich overnight.
Because this movie is about real estate.
Yeah.
A movie set in Hawaii, but very few beaches, very few vistas. Of course, that's the opening voiceover by Clooney. We see way more scenes in fairly boring, nice, but fairly boring houses. And the cities of Hawaii, where Matt's doing his job, offices, that kind of thing, which is also true about Payne's Nebraska set movies. Not just Nebraska the movie, but so many movies he's made have been in some way connected to Nebraska. This is one of the few where it has nothing to do with that state at all, because it was shot in Hawaii itself.
And Hawaii is like a character in the film.
But this is a real estate movie, because Brian's a realtor, Matt does real estate law, and then this land you mentioned earlier, where all the cousins, including Cousin Hugh, Beau Bridges' character, are battling for. Beau Bridges is a very nice guy actor. I don't always like him in real life. I assume the Bridges boys were raised right, because Jeff Bridges, if he's not a good dude and a nice guy, is an even better actor than we've ever said he was, because he seems like he really is, and I'm guessing Beau is the same. But Beau does play a similar kind of character in Jerry Maguire, a movie Chris and I covered years ago, one of the big hits. We all know Jerry Maguire.
A nice guy snake.
Mm-hmm. You're in the lobby with a black fella. Tells you everything, that one little line. He's been acting for over 70 years, because we're talking about when he was a little kid. And he's won 3 Emmys, I think, in various TV movie kinds of things. But you don't realize that Beau is so accomplished as well, not just his brother Jeff. And even though I think he's pretty good in the movie, the other cousins are pretty good in this movie, maybe you didn't need any of that. It just gives Matt something else to do. Yeah, you've got the contrast with the real estate. Also, this is my family. Everyone's called cousins, and yet we're not family. We barely know each other. My real family are my 2 daughters. And even in some weird, perverse way, I don't think Matt feels that yet, but maybe he will one day, Sid, because he is there for all of them, all 3 of them. But the cousins sure aren't. And in the end, they're not all bad people. But they're more concerned with their inheritance and this land. And you know what? As 2 people who just bought a house and who are in our mid... Well, I'm past mid-40. You're almost mid-40s. We can understand that motivation. It's not about gimme, gimme, gimme. But it is about, okay, especially Beau Bridges, but even the other cousins. I'm not 25 anymore. And if this is all of our land that we don't really care about anyway... And you're going to pull this, well, but this land means so much more. But does it, Matt? To you or anyone else? Yeah. To the Hawaiians, sure. To maybe elements of your family we didn't hear speak up. That's one thing. But Hugh and Matt, they don't care about the land. Matt can say he does. I don't think he's telling the truth at all. And I don't know that Payne and Rash and Faxon are onto that. I think they're making this whole, oh, I'm better than this moment happen for Clooney. But it isn't earned. And I don't think it's honest.
They even go to the trouble of having the family go to the land to see it, to show Scotty. They talk about how once upon a time they camped there, but they still are just standing apart from it, looking at it from a distance. They're not connecting with the land. They're not going there and interacting with nature, having family time there in a way that would make you believe that they have some personal connection to the land. It still remains this really abstract concept. I am... on the fence. Of course, I personally would root for the land to remain safe from exploitation and development. They make no effort to make you feel anything but disgust for the developer's plan for the place. This is where the Walmart will go. Well, nobody approves of that. But it's still a betrayal of the cousins. Whether he has a relationship with them or not, they've trusted Matt to act in their best interest and to represent the whole family.
And they voted to do this.
And they voted to do this. The movie doesn't end with him making some impassioned plea to his family to fight for their legacy. He just overrides their decision because he can. And it is this act of, for lack of a better word, privilege. Whatever put him in this position to be in charge of the family, maybe they voted him in because they trusted him. I can't remember if they ever actually give the detail of why he's the one that has the deciding vote.
Probably because he's in real estate law.
I guess he's like, somehow I ended up in this position.
But he's not an asshole, so this isn't a dick move. This isn't for me and my kids. I don't think that's what this is about at all.
No, he's not greedy, right? But of course, he's not greedy partially because he doesn't spend. They make many points of this in the movie. He's a lawyer. He makes a great living. And they have great lives. They have a really nice house. His wife could enjoy her hobbies, no matter what her father complained about. She should have been living high on the hog. Well, that's like a grieving father. It's clear that this family had more than enough and didn't need to dip into their money. So he has the security of this inheritance just sitting there. Money that he can do whatever he wants with, but he doesn't even need it. Versus family members who need the money. It's hard to take the sides of people who want to exploit land to get rich and to no longer struggle like the rest of us. But it's harder to sympathize with somebody who's like, oh, we all decided to vote, but guess what? Your vote means nothing.
His decision seems to come out of nowhere. I don't think it leads to that moment.
Right? It doesn't feel earned.
If it was supposed to be that I keep this land and it's for my daughters and all the daughters and all the sons, and then because he reconnects with them so strongly in the almost 2-hour long movie, I could see that. But that's not what that's about at all in this movie's case.
And not even just for our descendants, but for our ancestors. They are the descendants of ancestors who were the protectors of this land. That's almost a more compelling case. And they are always talking about that as a theme, that he is the descendant of royalty, that they have this family legacy. But it's another theme that just doesn't resonate with me. You have this really beautiful personal family story, and every time the film tries to make something really larger out of it, it's an interesting subplot that I enjoy watching, but I just, again, it doesn't feel cohesive.
Well, it's also a really important line in the movie that apparently is a quote from Warren Buffett, where Matt says in a voiceover, give your children enough to do something, but not enough to do nothing. So obviously he's planning to make sure his daughters have an opportunity, whether it be college education, maybe even a house. They'll probably live there in that house as long as they need to, realistically speaking. It's a nice place. Speaking of that house, by the way, of course, the movie ends in their house with them all watching March of the Penguins and sharing ice cream. Really nice moment to end the movie on as well.
Oh, beautiful, cathartic moment.
There's a blanket on their mother's bed. So Liz has this, I think, yellowish Afghan quilt's probably a better word for it, on her in the hospital. And at the end, the three of them are sharing that quilt.
Oh, I didn't notice that. That's a really beautiful
And, of course,
detail.
They're literally sharing ice cream because Clooney and Amara Miller, who does play Scotty, it's her first movie. She's only made one other one. She was pretty good in this movie, though, as a kid actress. I don't know if she can get more roles. But Clooney and Miller share ice cream, and then Woodley sits down, and then Clooney gives his ice cream to her, but then Miller, I'm giving the real names here, but anyway, gives her ice cream to him.
Yeah, they're all just
in the age of COVID, that's so freaky. Of course, it's also a family.
Well, whatever, they're a family, exactly.
But they are underneath Elizabeth's quilt. Maybe she made it, maybe she bought it, it was special to her.
And there's this familiarity in that moment. You keep talking about their chemistry, and it's never more evident than the three of them chilling on a couch, looking really comfortable with one another in a scene that I think most people would find familiar. This is how a family behaves. This is what comfort is. And this is what healing feels like, too. It really is in those small moments where you just quietly sit together and watch March of the Penguins and share ice cream under a blanket. And those can be the healing moments where this is the new normal, but the new normal is working for us.
And, of course, one of the red letter scenes in the whole film is much earlier on when Matt first finds out about the affair and goes over to talk to the friends, Rob Hubel, from I Love You Man, so funny in that, and many other things, of course.
A great Alexander Payne touch is him running to their house in flip-flops. So great!
It's funny, actually, because recently, before we even saw the movie, I was thinking about a moment where I think I was in flip-flops, I was barbecuing, or I was wearing them for some reason, I was in the house, and I thought I heard something outside with the dogs, and it felt like if I had to run after them, if you're determined enough, if it was your kid, or your dogs, or a friend, whatever it is, if you don't have proper shoes on, would you not just bolt out in the street even in bare feet? Flip-flops would be actually worse in a way because you
could easily be in bare feet.
You almost trip on them and that kind of thing. But it's played for comedy in this moment. And of course, he's so determined and he's schlubby as much as Clooney will ever look schlubby and disheveled and that kind of thing. And it's one of the funnier moments in a movie that does have comedy plenty of times. But that scene is the red letter moment for Clooney as far as comedy goes. He has to go and find out for sure from the friends that not only was she cheating, but she wanted a divorce. And maybe Matt really did, too, in the end, because it's not like he was happy either.
Yeah.
But then he was probably willing to settle for a going-through-the-motions marriage for a long time to come. And would have been fine with that if he had to be. Andy in Shawshank Redemption seems like some of the same things. Andy probably was relatively happy, or at least accepting of the way things were, but the wife really wasn't and cheated, and then something really bad came out of that. Not because of the cheating, per se. Well, in Shawshank, I guess it was. But anyway, you can see what I'm saying, I think, here.
I'm just even thinking now, most of Alexander Payne's films deal with infidelity. It's like a thing that he comes back to over and over again.
About Schmidt has an infidelity because on top of the fact that Warren had to retire against his will and finds out how irrelevant he had become so fast, and his daughter's not close to him, she's marrying some dumb fuck he has no respect for. But then Warren finds out that his wife cheated with one of his best friends. So there's infidelity in that movie too.
Matthew Broderick is cheating on his wife with his wife's best friend, and in Sideways, Thomas Hayden Church is sleeping with...
It's his engagement tour,
it's his bachelor
getaway
party
with Paul Giamatti, the two of them. It's a sowing the oats kind of deal, but you're about to marry this beautiful woman and you're going to mess around with anybody you want to? Well, okay, Alexander Payne, Rose McGowan, has accused him when she was underage. I don't remember what age it was. I think of rape, but at least molestation, something like that. You want to comment?
You want to corner me much? I had completely forgotten about this. I'm not proud of this, but I had actually just erased this from my mind. I'm an Alexander Payne fan, and I think when this happened, I was just overwhelmed by it or whatever. And
McGowan feels like not the most reliable source. I know that's not fair. You have to believe all women. Some people say that. No, it should be believe women. When I read about this, it was recently. Maybe she said it a long time ago, but I only read it recently. And it just feels like it might have happened. I don't know. But it's all about context. And it's maybe more importantly about, is this a repeat thing?
It is one of those situations when you have a single accuser and there's not really a lot to back up her story. I guess, waiting for more information to come to light. And I'm withholding my opinion. But that doesn't mean I'm calling her a liar. It just...
I'm not saying she's a liar either.
Yeah.
But this is a great example of he said, she said, when it's just two people. If somebody else came out and said, yeah, Payne did that to me too. Did it to me too. Then you start realizing, okay, three people.
For me, once there's two accusers, I start taking it a lot more seriously. Has he responded to the accusations?
He said it was untrue.
It kind of reminds me of the situation I know that you and Chris talked about with Lucas, how Corey Feldman has been this big whistleblower, but it's terrible to say this because I 100% believe that people hurt Corey Feldman. I 100%.
And Corey Haim.
And Corey Haim, yeah. I totally 100% believe that something happened to them, but Corey Feldman is just this loose cannon who doesn't seem like a really reliable accuser. You take everything he says with a bit of a grain of salt when there's nobody to really back him up.
And Rose McGowan is the lady version of Corey Feldman. Yeah,
it's very similar to Corey Feldman in that sense. I'm not calling her a liar. Absolutely not. And I know that people have hurt her. There's no question about that at all.
I see why people dodge this in movie podcasts unless there's an obvious one to rip on, like a Spacey or a Woody or a Weinstein. So let's move on.
Okay.
All right, so we've covered Clooney in Three Kings, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, and way back when, Gravity for the Now Playing Project, so four movies on this channel. And in two of those, he's got all the answers, although he does die in one of them, being Gravity. And Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, he doesn't have all the answers, but then he is also the smartest one of the dumbasses. I wonder if Matt and Liz wanted boys. Alex, Scotty, are their daughters' names? Now, of course, it's Alexandra, and we don't know what Scotty's actual name is. Is there a lady version of Scott?
No, if I had a daughter, which I never will, but I would want to give her a name that's kind of androgynous, just to give her a leg up on resumes, you know what I mean? And Alexandra is a great one, because Alex is this really androgynous name. You truly never know when you see Alex on an email. You don't know if it's a man or a woman. Scotty is just straight up a man's name.
I like that name, Alex, actually, for a boy or a girl.
Yeah, me too.
Man or a woman.
Yeah.
I did the It's Pat thing, and apparently that hasn't aged well either. Even though I think it was one of Julia Sweeney's best things, and it was also pretty funny and creative.
And considered one of the worst films in history.
Well, I'm sure the movie was terrible, but the character on SNL for five minutes was pretty good. So I mentioned Amara Miller only made one other movie in addition to this one, and Patricia Hastie, who plays Liz, the mom, only made three movies, and this is so far her final film. She's still alive, but hasn't made anything else. Nick Krause was in Boyhood a couple of years later. I don't really remember what role, but he's in that movie. We mentioned Lillard and Greer as the married couple. Greer is so funny in so many things, but Arrested Development might be one of her crowning achievements. Yeah. We talked about Beau Bridges already. Of course, Robert Forster is the father-in-law. Mulholland Drive's got a small role in that. Forster, who recently died, did so many films. We mentioned Payne, of course, directed and wrote and produced. He was a triple threat on this, was nominated in all three categories and won for writing. We covered Election, so look for that in the archives. I think it was at least 3 years ago, maybe more than that, maybe more like 5 years ago. And he wrote with Jim Rash and Nat Faxon, Rash from Community. So for those who might hear that name and think, where do I know the name from? He is Dean Pelton from Community. And Faxon and he write together quite often, not just in this case with Payne. There's that fun moment in the Oscars, and I'll post the Oscars speech on the website, where Jim Rash goes up and does the Angelina Jolie leg pose.
Oh, yeah.
I forgot it was that she presented to them.
Yes.
I thought that it was her doing that an hour before on the show, and it was apropos of nothing, and people wondered why Rash in a tuxedo was standing like that, but she had just done it.
It was,
where she stuck her leg out through her dress.
The most conscientious pose. She was doing it on the red carpet all night, and then she got up there and she kicked her leg out, and we're like, we get it. You have a leg.
She's very spindly. She's got to do the best she can to show off her body, because there's not that much of it.
That's true. So he worked with Nat Faxon and Jim Rash. It was a departure from his usual writing partner, Jim Taylor, who I think was credited as a producer or co-producer on this
film. He was a producer, yeah.
Maybe that's where this film lost a bit of its edge. Maybe Jim Taylor deserves credit for taking his screenplays to this much more misanthropic level than The Descendants went.
Yeah, because the screenplays were about Schmidt and Election, I would say we're better than this. And I don't
like
Sideways,
agree.
But I can see why people like the Sideways screenplay more. I think my problem with Sideways, and I think he's a tremendous actor, but Paul Giamatti is so annoying in that movie after a while. Again, his performance is not the problem. It's the way he's written. Well, I guess his performance is part of the problem. But I didn't sympathize with him through the whole film. Virginia Madsen's character is tremendous. And even though Thomas Hayden Church is a buffoon, he's so funny that you at least enjoy him. But after a while, stop whining Giamatti's character. It's too bad that I feel that way, because I do think he's terrific in most movies.
I agree with you. Sideways is maybe the movie that's gotten Alexander Payne the most praise, but is not my favorite.
I prefer Election and About Schmidt. I think I've already made that clear.
Yes.
But Nebraska, I would put third.
Yeah. Listen, Sideways, maybe I need to watch it again, but I've never actually revisited it. I think I watched it twice when it first came out, but I've never gone back and watched it a third time. I definitely should, because I'm sure there's lots about that movie to like, but I agree with you. I'm just discouraged where the lead character is just so unlikable that it crosses the line for me. Even though Paul Giamatti can, make even an unlikable character pretty watchable. The big moment in that film where Virginia Madsen puts her hand on his hand and you know that she's kind of inviting him. And of course, in the movie, in the moment, I'm like, why would she like him? He, even in that moment, can't take her advance. He is just inviting all this trouble himself and I'm out.
It is fun watching him drink a vintage bottle of wine at McDonald's, though.
There's lots of fun things about that movie. Listen, it's very charming.
And Sandra Oh's freak out on Thomas Hayden Church. And she was married to Payne during that time frame because she's sitting beside him when he goes up to win the award. So one of his actresses was his wife.
I thought that they met on set and that's how they fell in love.
Well, she was at the Oscars, though, so maybe that's what it was.
Mm-hmm. They definitely were married and they are not anymore. Right. So maybe she has a take on the whole Alexander Payne statutory rape thing.
The producers were Payne, Jim Taylor, who won an Oscar for Sideways for writing it with him. So like we said, Taylor was involved. He's not a writer this time. And Jim Burke, who won an Oscar for producing Green Book. Ugh, not a good choice. Another road movie, though, too. The movie's 2-3-5-1. We watched it on Stars, meaning the Canadian. Maybe it's not Canadian, but it stars up here. I think that is actually an American thing, too. Although it is on Disney Plus as well, Descendants is, because it's a Fox property. The cinematographer, Faden Papamichael, also shot a movie that we will be covering, Chris and I, Ford vs. Ferrari. Payne, actually, I think the next movie was Nebraska, and did black and white with that. Mm-hmm. The editor, Kevin Tent, worked on Election. He's a Payne regular, so he cuts most, if not all, of his films. And the composer, Jeff Peterson, is his only movie score ever. He mostly does TV and especially award shows. You look on his IMDb profile.
Does he always do this kind of regional Hawaiian ukulele? Because the whole score is very Hawaiian.
I didn't look at that. Maybe that's what it is.
And it's very chill, Jimmy Buffett. It makes you feel like you are on a resort in Hawaii, even though
the movie's nothing about that at all.
Definitely not trying to evoke
it's ironic
that resort
music.
Feel. Yeah. And you talk about the look. I mean, they make Hawaii look bland and suburban.
Not bad, but
not
pretty boring.
Not bad, but all the outdoor scenes take place on these overcast, blustery days, with some obvious exceptions. But for the most part, it just really makes you feel like you're in every town in America.
And the few times they're on the beach could be any old beach, really.
Yeah.
But it was actually made in Hawaii, so that was some Hawaiian beach, just not the lost beaches, if
It'd
you will.
It'd be so easy to make Hawaii look beautiful and to give in to the temptation to take advantage of this lush, verdant, beautiful landscape and the skies and the ocean and everything. But instead, they resisted temptation and made a film about every town in America that just happens to be Hawaii.
And I said Lost, as in the TV show Lost. So you thought the look was pretty good, appropriate, especially the cutting and the music. I guess we agree, though, that even though the cutting was fine and was nominated for the Oscar, a large chunk of this movie could have been gone, meaning the family strife about that land.
Maybe it's something that works better in the novel than really worked in the film. And as an editor, I just genuinely don't know how I would have fixed that problem. Although you could fix a lot in the ensuite of this film because it relies so heavily on narration. So you can actually dramatically change the film in post-production by just rewriting narration. Ask Woody Allen with Annie Hall.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, hard to say, but that was a problem that they did not solve. Other than that, though, the pace is great. It's a very watchable film with tons of forward momentum. I never get bored. I'm never looking at the clock. You don't want it to end. Love the score in the sense that it keeps the tone light and is super appropriate for the setting. And, of course, I already talked about the cinematography.
As for what happens next, well, they finished watching the overrated Penguins movie. Never was a huge fan of that movie.
Oh, wow.
It's fine, but not worth all the praise it got back then. The huge box office, one of the most successful documentaries of all time.
Just about enough of your penguin bashing.
But they finished watching that. Then the next morning, Cousin Hugh whacks Matt in a drive-by. Screw with my land, will ya? Motherfucker.
Those cousins, they ought to be pretty mad. By the way, they mentioned something about this specific legal situation they're in with the land, and I ambitiously looked it up to see if I could understand it, and I cannot. It makes no sense to me. But I did, from what I read, gather that Matt's not going to save that land. They have to sell it in 7 years. Like he says, they have 7 years to figure out what to do with it, and those developers are just going to wait.
You can't stop progress, and unfortunately, progress is about building Walmarts and golf courses.
It's not even just about progress. It's about how many people can own an inheritance like that. It's a trust, even. It's not an inheritance. They don't really own the land.
Right.
They're just the keepers of a trust. How long can a trust last? Well, there's a limit.
Okay, last thoughts on our last movie for a few weeks. We'll take a week off next week, The Descendants.
Well, we both agree that it is not Alexander Payne's best outing, but even bad Alexander Payne is better than most films, especially most films of a kind of dying genre of the family dramedy, an intimate, well-written, well-acted, small film like this. So, high thumbs up for me.
And pandemic notwithstanding, that gets released in the theaters. Because a movie like this will get released on Prime or Netflix.
Yeah.
Disney Plus will probably start doing original content of this type at some point. But getting comedies, or in this case a dramedy, released on the big screen is not going to be as easy as it used to be. And often they're the biggest hits of the year in the history of film.
Yeah.
Even relatively recently, some of the Bridesmaids. We talked about it only a few months ago. One of the biggest hits of 2011. Didn't cost much. Huge hit. But comedies have gone the way of the dodo as far as getting big releases. Again, pandemic changed all of that, but that would have been true this year and last year as much as anything had it not been for the pandemic. Well, like I said, this is certainly not my favorite Payne. I don't think it's really anything special, even though there are some pretty great moments in it, especially the stuff with Clooney and Woodley, but that's more in a small way. The moments that build and you realize this does feel like a father-daughter, yet he's talking to her like an adult. I like so many things about their relationship, her performance, his performance. And of course, Nick Kraus as Sid quietly steals the movie from even them, which is saying an awful lot. But to have won the Oscar over Moneyball, which I think was the best screenplay that year of the adapted nominees, the five of them. So that's one of the reasons I think why I struggle to think that this and The Artist were raved about so much that year. What is wrong with Hollywood in 2011?
And I agree with you. Moneyball is a better movie.
Okay, in 7 days, you won't be hearing a new episode from us because, as I said, we're taking our first week off since March. We'll be at a cottage catching some rays and sleeping late. When we get back at it in 14 days, we'll be posting episode number 400. How appropriate that we get to that milestone by gabbing about the quiet French film, The 400 Blows. That was Bev's suggestion. I was thinking, what do we do? It's a number thing. Maybe we'd play off of 300. We do that movie. Not that I'm a huge fan of 300. Bev said 400 Blows. I looked up other 400 movies. I don't know if there's anything else. But we haven't covered
not a lot of competition.
We haven't covered Truffaut ever. We haven't covered a lot of French films. It makes a lot of sense. So 400 Blows for number 400. The coming attractions opinion question for The 400 Blows. Which of these is your favorite movie with a number in the title? 7, One Flew of the Cuckoo's Nest, 12 Angry Men, 21 Jump Street, 2001 A Space Odyssey, The Three Colors Trilogy, or The 400 Blows?
So for our answers to that question, check out our next podcast about The 400 Blows. In the meantime, you can check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to favorite or subscribe to us wherever you listen. All of our episodes are available for free, and that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 98 and or 2007 list of the best American films ever made, and hundreds more titles on top of that. And while you're there, please give us a rating and a review that helps people find us. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to you in Canada or the U.S., please go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code TOP100PROJECT, and that's all one word, TOP100PROJECT, is not case sensitive, and that will get you a 20% discount.
Mahalo.
Aloha.
Mahalo, motherfucker. It can go fuck itself.
And cut.